Good afternoon. Well, firstly, thank you all for coming. I got here about 20 minutes ago and there was nobody here. I was convinced this was going to be me and three other people and we were going to escape to the pub and just have a conversation there. So I'm glad you've all showed up for the Visual Studio Deep Dive 400 technical session. Seriously. No, just kidding. So my name's Steve Clayton. I'm here to talk to you a little bit about storytelling. So hopefully that is the session that you've come along for, how to tell awesome stories. And a couple of things. One is, again, thanks so much for coming. I also want to thank Terry Chapman from Microsoft, who's been putting this track on at Microsoft for a while. I think it's a real smart thing to do. You know, we have lots of technical tracks at this conference. It's the biggest IT conference in New Zealand, as you guys know. And I think it's a really good learning that we can take back to some of our other conferences. Terry and I were just talking about, I was at the Ignite conference in Chicago earlier this year, and we had about 18,000 people, maybe a little bit more, actually. And we didn't have these kinds of tracks. So I think it's, we're not quite using you as guinea pigs, but if you go to Ignite in Chicago next year, then you might see this same session show up. So what are we going to talk about? Well, every good story sort of has three chapters. So I'm going to take this whole thing in three chapters and start by talking about why I think stories are important. Then talk about a brief history of stories at Microsoft and then give you some of these secrets. I think maybe the reason that you're here is these tips on what have we learned at Microsoft, what have I learned over my time at Microsoft around secrets to telling awesome stories. So stick around for the three chapters. I'll start with my favorite story, of course, talk about myself for a little bit, but just a little bit of background on me briefly. That's me. If you have any questions during the session or after the session or next week or the week after, feel free to email me or send me a tweet. I'm at SteveCLA. I was born in the UK in a place called Liverpool. Show of hands, who knows Liverpool? We've got heckling already. That's awesome. I'm actually pretty happy to be in this theater. I know, anyone else notice outside, Al Murray is either going to be at this theater or has just been at this theater. Anyone know Al Murray? Show of hands. Pub landlord. It's awesome. All the best stories start in pubs. And we're on the stage where the pub landlord is going to appear. So anyway, the reason I mention being from Liverpool, I've been asked this question a lot around, well, how did you get into storytelling? How did you find yourself in this job? Because when I started at Microsoft 18 years ago, as it says up there, I studied computer science at a place called Loughborough in the UK, which my friends in America call Luga Baruga, but it is Loughborough. And so I've been on this journey at Microsoft. I started out as a technical sales guy, what we used to call a systems engineer. So I used to be relatively technical, and now I'm not technical in any way at all. And I've sort of tried to trace back the history of how did I end up in this job with a job title at Microsoft of Chief Storyteller. And I think the reason is, growing up, I was surrounded by people who were great storytellers. You know, I remember sitting at home around the fireplace, my grandmother there, my grandfather there, my uncles, and they're all great storytellers. And it's a little bit why I think stories are important. I'll come on to in a second. But I've been at Microsoft about 18 years, been in Seattle for 5 years. I spent the last 8 years, I like to talk about it, telling stories as a hobby, and the last 5 years finding stories as a job. So I'll tell you a little story about the 8 year and 5 year piece of this. So about 8 years ago, 9 years ago, I was working in Microsoft in the UK in a, sir, you have a Tusker t-shirt on. Round of applause for that man. Kenya beer, awesome. We'll come back to Kenya in a few moments. So 8 years ago, I was in Microsoft UK, and my job there was to recruit mobile partners into the Microsoft ecosystem to get them to build on our, as you know, phenomenal mobile platform. So I used to spend most of my evenings in pubs and in bars and in these kind of startup communities in the City of London. And I'd go into these communities, and you sort of know how these things go. A group of people will get up, and they'll talk about a particular topic, and then at the end there'll be some Q&A, and you're invited to ask questions. And of course, when you ask questions, you have to raise your hand, and you say, I'm from company X, and here's my question. So I would go to these things probably two or three a week for quite a period of time, and I'd put my hand up, and I'd say, my name's Steve, and I'm from Microsoft. And you'd hear this sprinkling of laughter through the audience, like, Microsoft are here. What are they doing here? They're so old. They're so boring. They're so tired. And it really started to get to me. And so I decided to begin to write a blog about the company. So 8 or 9 years ago, I started this blog, and it was called Geek in Disguise. And it gained some notoriety in the UK and inside of Microsoft, because any good blog, you need to have some controversial stuff on there, or you're never going to get any traffic. So, you know, at times I would be critical of the company, because it also helps to be authentic if you're going to do that kind of thing. Anyway, fast forward 3 years after the blog had been running, And I'm at home in London on a Tuesday night, a wet Tuesday, not unlike yesterday here in Auckland. And the telephone goes, 8 o'clock in the evening, phone rings, pick up the phone. And the voice on the other end of the line says, Steve, it's Frank Shaw. Frank Shaw runs communications for all of Microsoft. I said, oh, hello, Frank. I didn't really know Frank at all at the time. It's Frank Shaw. Hello, Frank. What can I do for you? Well, Steve, I'd like to talk to you about your blog. You're like, I think this is the day I'm going to lose my job. Really, Frank, what would you like to talk about? He said, well, it turns out I really like your blog, and I think you should come to Seattle and do that as a full-time job. Like, this is bizarre. Hang on a second, Frank. Turn to my wife. Honey, I think I've just been offered my dream job, but it might require us to move to Seattle. Hang on for a second. Back to Frank. Tell me more about this, Frank. Well, you know, you do a great job of evangelism, and we sort of need a technical evangelist to work in the communications department at Microsoft, and we think you're just the man. So I'd like to offer you the job. Back to my wife. Yep, definitely being offered my dream job. Hang on a second, I'll check if he's going to pay me. Frank, this appears to be my dream job. Are you planning to pay me? Yes, I'm going to promote you as well. Honey, we're moving to Seattle. I swear, 3 weeks later, we moved to Seattle. Literally, I said, that's it, I'm going to take this job, and I had my dream job. I got to go and spend my days running around Redmond, meeting interesting people, finding stories, publishing those stories, talking about the company, and helping to change perception. There's another phenomenal story that if I do meet any of you in the pub, which is highly likely within the next 2 or 3 days, the story around how my wedding got put together in a 3-week period, and then I got trapped in Seattle a week before my wedding. At the same time, a volcano erupted in Iceland, which some of you may remember. And trying to get back across the Atlantic when there's a volcano erupting and your wedding's here and you're here is quite a stressful situation. That's a lovely shot you've just taken, sir. Thank you for that. So anyway, we are 5 minutes in and we're on the second slide, so we're not making great progress here, so we'll crack on a little bit. But why stories? Why do stories matter? Partly the reason I just told you that story is it engages people. And, you know, maybe one or two of you will retell that story at some point. We are built and designed as a species to tell stories, to capture stories, to retell stories, to embellish stories. And in a world where we have too much information, you know, by the time you've woken up in the morning, you've been bombarded by the time you get to the office with 10 gigabytes of information from radio, TV, broadcast, billboards, websites, Twitter, SMS messages. We're constantly bombarded with information. But to get back to the pub, which we will revisit several times during this talk, you never go down to the pub, right, and somebody says, I've got some data to tell you. Can't wait to tell you some data. They don't do that. They tell you a story about a place they went to or a piece of music they heard or a movie that they saw. We are built to consume stories, to tell stories, and to retell stories. And so I believe very strongly that in this world where we have too much information that we're swimming around in, stories are what are going to allow us to break through into this world where nobody cares. And this is what stories are. This is fairly obvious stuff, but I love this infographic. And because I'm from Liverpool, I stole it from somebody else's website. I didn't create it myself. I'm glad some of you got that gag. But this is what it's about. You know, we all know what corporate speak is. We all know that when somebody puts the word super in front of something, that's corporate speak. Super awesome. Super good. That's corporate speak. And stories are very different. They take people on a journey. They're conversational. They don't use jargon. They have heroes. They have texture. They have ups and downs. They have cameramen who are going to stand there and take a photograph of your nose, and it's going to look awful, but I imagine it's going to be a great photo. So let's talk a little bit about stories, and we'll talk about photographers as well shortly. What are the archetypes of a story? So contrary to Laura's keynote last night, where she didn't want to talk about Star Wars, I do want to talk about Star Wars. Show of hands, is there anybody in the room who hasn't seen Star Wars and is prepared to put their hand up in the room and admit it? Sir, you get his Tusker t-shirt. Star Wars is, I think we can all agree, the best story on the planet. And they need to do a damn good job of, you know, keeping it good with the next edition. But the reason, truly, that Star Wars is a great story is because it has all of the characteristics of a great story. It has heroes, it has villains, it has a cast of characters who go on a journey. There are inciting incidents, there's a call to action, and people end up transformed at the end of that journey. And that's very different from, let's say, a case study, where a case study says, company wanted to buy a collaboration solution, and they found SharePoint. And they tested it, and it was terrific. And they deployed 100,000 seats of it. Case studies are good, but they're not stories. They don't take people on a journey. They don't have texture. So I kind of have a little bit of a problem with case studies. So that leads me on neatly to chapter two of this story, a not-so-brief history of stories at Microsoft. And so we'll start with the first day I arrived at Microsoft just a little over 5 years ago to this dream job that Frank had given me and was paying me for and promoting me for. And day one on the job, I thought, oh, what am I going to do? Like, how am I going to approach this? And I did take quite a while thinking about how is the way to tell stories here about this incredible company with incredible people that's going to break through in a different kind of way. And so I came up with this model called People, Places, Process, and Products. And I basically decided that whenever I was going to tell a story, I would tell it by combining at least two of these P's. And what that means is if I was going to tell a story about Xbox, for example, I wasn't going to tell a straight-up story about Xbox. I was going to tell it by the people who produced Xbox, or the process that they went through to get to Xbox, or the place where Xbox was built. I'm fascinated with places, physical spaces, I think, tell a lot of a rich story around people. You know, when people arrive at your home, they sort of look around and they look at your bookshelf and they see what books you read and they look at your furniture and they create an impression because that is all part of the story of you. So I'm fascinated by places as a way to tell stories. So I'll tell you a little story about one of the stories I told using this model early on. Everybody's hopefully familiar with Kinect, you know, motion sensing, amazing technology from Alex Kipman. And when Kinect came out, I guess probably best part of 3 years ago now, one of the stories that we told behind Kinect was the journey that the team had been on to build Kinect. And the story sort of goes a little bit like this, that they were trying to compete with the Wii controller, which was very popular at the time, and decided that ultimately they could create something that was going to be, wouldn't require a controller at all. And there were a group of people in Microsoft who truly believed you could do that, and there were a group of people inside of Microsoft who truly believed you couldn't do that. And the people who thought you could do this, they had a couple of what they called impossible dreams. There were a few core pieces of technology that they knew were virtually impossible, but they believed that they could build these things. One of them was an acoustic array microphone that allows you to have a microphone that can pick out individual audio in a room of sort of not quite this size, but in a very noisy room, it can pick out distinct pieces of audio. Incredible piece of technology that came out of Microsoft Research. So the Kinect team are there, you know, probably 6 months before they want to launch this thing, and they're missing one piece of technology, quite a key piece of technology, the ability to be able to see a human body moving sort of like this and be able to interpret that at 30 frames per second. So they were convinced that this technology could be created, and they thought, well, maybe somebody else has created it. Maybe it's out there on the web. Maybe we can go and license this technology from somebody else. And so off they went and searched around the web, and they found it. They found a white paper all about this piece of technology, the exact technology they needed to complete the journey of Kinect. And they frantically read through the paper thinking, this is awesome. Like, who created this? Who are we going to license it from? Do we need to go and buy this company? And they got to the end of the paper and it said, Microsoft Research, Cambridge, England. This technology had been in the company for 7 years and was just stored in a cupboard in Cambridge in England, which is totally fine because that's what research is about looking over the horizon around technologies that sometimes we don't really know if we're going to need them. But it turns out on this occasion, it turned out to be a real success, and Jamie Shelton from Cambridge joined up with the Kinect team and they built that piece of technology. But that was the story we told. We didn't tell the story about here's Kinect and here's all the things it can do. Our product marketing team did that and did a very good job of it, but we wanted to tell the story behind the product, and so we took people on that journey. So ultimately, we ended up creating this website. It's called Microsoft Stories, and you can go there today, microsoft.com/stories, and you'll find a rich array of stories about people in Microsoft, about places in Microsoft, about products, about process, all encapsulated in this beautiful website. But I want to take you on a little bit of a journey as well as to how we got to that website, how we really started to think about stories and the craft of stories. And it all started with this story called Snowfall that was written by John Branch about 2.5 years ago now, maybe 3 years ago, and appeared in the New York Times. And has anyone seen Snowfall, familiar with it? Show of hands. A few. If you haven't, you should go and see it. It's still on the web. It looks now just like a very nice story. When this came out, it was groundbreaking. Nobody had done imagery like this. Nobody had thought about how do you take a 12,000-word story and illuminate that story at just the right point. So you get to this point in the story. And the story is it's quite a tragic story of 12 skiers who lost their lives in an avalanche not far from our Seattle headquarters, as it turns out, in a mountain range out there. And the story is phenomenal, 12,000 words. It's the only thing I can remember reading on the web from start to finish in the history of the web. And it's 12,000 words. It's huge. I mean, we all know, we go onto the web. You know, you go onto the web today, and you read half a page, and like, boring, click. Read half a click, and you're just clicking around the web. Imagine sitting down and reading 12,000 words on a screen on a web page. That's how compelling the story was. The story itself won a Pulitzer Prize. But what to us was compelling was the delivery of the story. At just the right point in the story where you were introduced to one of the characters, it was illuminated with a sub-story about that person. At just the right point when you were thinking, I don't really know anything about avalanches. How do they get created? How do they happen? They have this wonderful animated infographic that basically told you the story of how an avalanche happens. So we looked at that and we said, we've got some amazing stories at Microsoft. Not quite as amazing as that story. We're not going to win a Pulitzer Prize, but we think we can deliver the stories in the same way. And so we did. And if this looks familiar, it's because we shamelessly copied Snowfall. And we were very public about that. We built a story that we called 88 Acres. It was 3,000 words long. And it was a story all about this guy, Daryl Smith, who works in our real estate and facilities department. So we'll pause for a second and I have another sub-story to tell you that starts in a pub, again, as all stories do. So I was in a pub. We have a pub on our Microsoft campus in Redmond. And I met this friend of mine, Josh, and he said, Steve, I've got this incredible story for you to take to the media. He wanted me to package the story up and take it to a media outlet. And I said, really, Josh, what's the story? He said, it's a story about real estate and facilities at Microsoft. You're thinking, whew, this is going to be phenomenal. Real estate and facilities. I get to talk with Alex Kitman about the Kinect, the creation of Kinect, and you want me to go and chat with real estate and facilities about buildings? He's like, trust me, it's worth an hour of your time. I'm so happy I took that hour of the time. So I went and met this guy, Daryl. He sort of lives and works in this very nondescript building on our campus in Redmond. The campus was originally 88 acres in size, which became the code name for the story. So I met with Daryl, and I got to his building. I'm like, oh, this is going to be a waste of an hour, but, you know, I'll do it anyway. So I get there. I'm like, hi, Daryl. What's the story? He's like, have I got a story for you? And he basically unfolds over the course of the next half an hour this incredible big data meets IoT story. His team had been spending the last 2 years instrumenting all of Microsoft campus to the point that if a fire extinguisher gets tampered with in one of our buildings, somebody in his office knows immediately. If an air conditioning unit fails above Steve Clayton's head in his office, somebody knows. They don't care, but somebody knows. But if an air conditioning unit fails in the Windows build lab, somebody knows, and they get over there pronto and they fix that thing. So we had this really pretty fascinating story over two years ago around big data meets IoT. And so we packaged it up, and we said, this is like worthy of taking to the media. So we went to a couple of big media outlets, I won't name them, and we said, we've got this amazing story for you. And they both said, not interested. It's no news, you know, it's just not interested. So we're like, well, we'll tell this thing ourselves. So that's what we did. We built out this story, and it's still on the web. If you search for 88 acres, this will be the first hit that you get, and it tells you the whole story of big data at Microsoft. It was fascinating. What was more fascinating is what happened the day that we published this story. So we published it on a Tuesday. Everything happens on a Tuesday in my life, I'm starting to realize. We published this thing on a Tuesday, and we got to the weekend, and I remember I was walking around Seattle with my wife on the Saturday, and I got this email on my phone from Daryl, and it said, Steve, thanks for all the work on the 88 Acres story. Just wanted to let you know how much of a success it's been. I'm like, oh, that's nice. He sent me a nice. And we actually had about 250,000 page views in the first 48 hours. It got picked up by mainstream media. We didn't publicize this thing at all. It appeared on TechMeme, which, you know, if you get on TechMeme, you're doing well from a storytelling point of view. But the real juice of this is Daryl said to me, well, I got this really interesting phone call on the Tuesday afternoon, Steve. He says, I thought it was a prank telephone call. And I said, well, who was it from? He said, it was from the governor of the state of Tennessee. And I said, really, what did he want? He said he wanted to buy 88 acres. He phoned me up and he said, I've just read your story on the web and I want one of those. Daryl said, one of which? He said, that 88 acres thing, I want to do that for the state of Tennessee. I said, oh, that's nice. And then the next day, Nestle phoned up, and the day after, BMW phoned up, and the day after, Walmart phoned up, and the day after, the government of Singapore phoned up. This guy who runs real estate facilities, he manages buildings. He's an incredibly cool dude. But then he had a multi-million dollar sales pipeline off the back of a story. The challenge with that for me is my management team now think every story I create is going to build a multi-million dollar sales pipeline, but that's by the by. But it did help me get some more budget to tell a few more stories. So then we got the chance to tell this story. 18 months ago, we got this new CEO. And if you're in communications, if you're in PR, the way that you do this, the way you announce, you know, traditionally the way you announce a new CEO to the world is you phone up the media, you write a press release, you publish it, and then you sit back and you do a whole bunch of interviews. And we said, we're not going to do that because we know how that goes. We know how that story goes. So we invested a ton of time. 3 days before Satya was announced, there was a group of us who were on the campus in a hidden place, creating videos of him, taking photographs of him, interviewing him, doing this ridiculous sort of walk and talk interview that I got to do with him, which was fantastically good fun, but nobody believed would work. And we ended up with, I think, 750,000 views of that video. The Financial Times wrote a story and said, basically said this. They said, bloody Microsoft, it's our job to tell this story, and they've told it themselves. We were like, yes, that's exactly what we wanted to do, tell our story our way. And so we've had a lot of fun telling stories with Satya over the last 18 months, and he's been a great person to tell stories with. I've had the chance to work with him a lot, and it's been a lot of fun. So having gone on that journey and having spent the last 18 months really investing more and more in stories and thinking much more deeply about what does it mean to really to do stories, I thought I would share some of the, what I think are some of the, not so much the secrets, but things that we've learned that I think we can sort of pass on. First, this may seem incredibly obvious, but the key to great storytelling is actually to start with a great story. And what we built inside of Microsoft is lots of, you go to this website, microsoft.com/stories, and there are some beautiful stories on there. And what it created actually was a problem for us internally, that lots of teams internally would come to us and say, we want to tell a story on your platform with those big splashy photos and videos and all of those things that you do that get people excited. And our question to them, so one of them, I won't mention the name, but one of our engineering teams came to us about a year ago and said, we want to tell a story about product X. We're like, okay, great. Who is the hero? What is the journey they've gone on? What's the transformation? What's the conflict here? And what's the outcome? And they said, we don't know what you're talking about. We just want to tell a story about product X. Like, yes, that's marketing. And marketing is great, and I love it, but it's not stories. So it really, truly does... If you really want to, you know, think about this craft of storytelling, is to stop and pause and question people and say, is there really a story here? Or is it something that's masquerading as a story? Another way to think about it is, you know, when you read a magazine, you read in, you know, Wired or whatever, Condé Nast Traveler, whatever magazine it is, and you get to one of those pieces and you go, that looks like content, but it smells different. And then it has that little phrase at the top and it says advertorial content. Like, you're not really a story, are you? You're an advert that's masquerading as a story. And so I would encourage you to be just careful and thoughtful about that, that try not to, if it smells and feels like that type of thing, then it's not really a story. So let me give you an example of a great story. This is a great story that, or what I think is a great story that we told recently, that has some heroes that went on a journey. So I had the great fortune to travel to Kenya about 3 weeks ago and tell this story with our CEO. And the story here, that thing, so this lady is called Beatrice, and she's the principal of a school in the middle of rural Kenya in Africa. And the girl on the left, or the girl on her right, I should say, is Tiffany. And the thing behind them is it's a Wi-Fi radio mast. And so the story that we told here a few weeks ago was how Microsoft has changed our mission statement recently. To really focus around how do we empower every person and organization on the planet to achieve more. And we deeply believe in that. How do we help people achieve more, every organization and every person on the planet? Not in Silicon Valley, not in New York, not in Europe, on the planet. It's a grand scale ambition. And I think this turned out to be a great story that told the scale of that ambition. And the story goes a little bit like this. 20 years ago, two farmers, Tim and Maggie, British as it turns out, started growing flowers, roses, very, very expensive, very distinct roses in this place called Nanyuki in the middle of Kenya. It's about 200 kilometers north of Nairobi. And as time went on, they decided that they needed to be connected to the internet to really run this business and to sell these flowers to these high-end stores around the world. And the internet access that they had was very expensive and not very good. And they thought there must be a better way. So they ran into a friend of theirs, a Scotsman. I imagine they ran into this guy, Malcolm, in a pub because he's an excellent drinker and introduced me to the fine Tusker, Kenyan beer of epic proportions. So anyway, they met Malcolm, and Malcolm was working on a similar challenge, but he was working on it on the Outer Hebrides and the Isle of Bute in Scotland. And he had the same challenge. He was in a remote rural area that had no internet access. And so he managed to find a piece of technology that, again, was from Microsoft Research, and it's called TV White Spaces. And so some of us in the room look old enough that we remember the good old days when to get TV signal, you'd put a mast on the side of your house, this giant thing, and it got TV signal over the 5 gigahertz UHF spectrum. But now, because everybody's getting their TV signal through either satellite or through cable, that spectrum, that radio spectrum, is no longer being used. It turns out to be very precious and very useful radio spectrum. Because if you think about the Wi-Fi router in your house, it has a range of, let's say, 15 or 20 meters at best, and then it starts to drop off quite quickly. But if you take one of these things, in fact, if you go down from the top, the thing at the top is actually a microwave connection. The one beneath it, I'm not sure. And then the one beneath that you can't quite see is one of these sort of squareals. It's about this big. And it's basically a Wi-Fi broadcast hotspot, same as you kind of have in your house, just happens to be on the side of a mast. But it also happens to be using this TV radio spectrum, which means instead of broadcasting over 20 meters, this thing broadcasts 15 kilometers from that single mast. What that means is every school in the region that previously never had internet access now has internet access over the last 2 years. Their school grades have taken off. They've gone through the roof. You've now got kids at those schools who are now going to university. They previously would have never got to university because of the quality of education that they're able to get through internet access. The local Red Cross office used to have to drive 300 or 400 kilometer round trip every week to deliver reports into Nairobi on blood transfusions and blood use up in the rural areas. Now they have internet access. They can do that stuff instantly. So it's transformed. It's taken these people, Tim and Maggie and Malcolm, on a journey where they basically now run a not-for-profit organization called Mawingu in the middle of Kenya, delivering internet access to underserved communities. And there are other companies who are trying to do this. You know, there's companies that are putting balloons up in the air. There's companies who are trying to fly drones around. And it's all noble efforts. But the reality is this thing is out there and it's working. 200,000 people are now connected on this technology. And that, to me, is a true story. It had some heroes, Malcolm, Tim, and Maggie, who went on a journey. They came up against some challenges because they needed to get financing to do this. But it really is a beautiful, true story. So back to my point around, you know, really, if you think about it, press and see, is there a story there? And often it is, who is the question right behind that is, who's the hero? What is the journey that they went on? The second thing I wanted to share is, in storytelling, you really are in the image business. And we're all familiar with this idea of a picture tells 1,000 words. And I've learned that again and again and again over the last 18 months. And so part of the work that we've invested in over those last 18 months is really employing great photographers, in particular one great photographer that we have who works with us called Brian, who took this photograph. And you truly can change people's perception and change people with images and with great photography, and I'll show you a few examples of that. I'll tell you the story behind this image. So this was the day that we announced Satya as, I'm checking time because I want to make sure that we've got some time for Q&A. This was the day we announced Satya to the world. And we had an employee rally in the company in one of our buildings in Seattle. And this is a four-story building with a giant atrium. There were people literally hanging off the edge of this thing, the atrium. It was like a zoo. And I'd said to Brian, when this photo was taken, I was stood approximately here, like where I'm stood now. And Brian, the photographer, was stood next to me. And I had this image, and I nearly fell off. And that would have been embarrassing. I am not drunk, just to be clear. The image I had in my mind was this very clean, crisp, amazing image of the three CEOs of Microsoft. We only ever have three CEOs, and it's those three guys. And I said to Brian, listen, Brian, I'll pay you today anyways, but I said, the shot I'm really paying you to get, please get this shot, is our three CEOs stood together, Satya in the middle, flanked by Steve and Bill. And Brian, if you can, get one where they're all smiling at the same time, which is virtually impossible. So I remember being stood here, I'm gonna try not to fall off, and I'm stood next to Brian, I'm thinking, he's never going to get this shot. It's impossible because the place is a zoo. It's utter chaos. And there's just this noise, there's things going on. And so he fires off a few frames, and an hour later we go and review the photographs, me thinking we're not going to have a great photo here. And then we come across this photograph, and I looked at it, and I'm like, that is the perfect photograph for a few reasons. Number one, they're all smiling. Number two, Satch is in the middle, flanked by Steve and Bill. Number three, and I swear to you, this image has not been photoshopped. Every phone in there is a Microsoft phone. Every one of them, and they're colorful. They're very clearly Lumia phones. And it also just, actually, instead of me, I wanted this very clean image of the three of them. It captured the energy of the moment. You can see these smiling faces, people cheering, people applauding. And I thought, this is it. We've got this amazing photo. What are we gonna do with it? How are we gonna use this to help tell the story of the day? And so we put it out on the web, and then this happened. The Wall Street Journal took our photo and put it on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, but so did the New York Times, so did USA Today, so did the Financial Times, so did the Times of London. And we realized at that moment that investing in imagery in a very serious way, and actually not in a nefarious way, not concocting images, but creating great imagery that helped to tell a story, helps those stories travel far and wide. Those photographs that we took in Kenya, if you get the chance, go and take a look at that story. It's at news.microsoft.com/Kenya2015. And there is some phenomenal photography in there, and the photography has helped that story to travel far and wide. And so over the last 18 months, we've taken lots of photographs of our CEO. And so I did this little experiment recently that I went to Bing, and you can do this on Google as well, and you search for Satya Nadella, and you click on the Images tab. 75% of those images are taken by my photographer, by my friend Brian. And you'll probably, I'm sure, have seen some of those photographs, whether it's in Microsoft publications or on other people's websites. And it's shown us that we can help curate and create and change this image. If you go and do that same search for, you know, previous CEOs, for example, you'll see a different set of photos that aren't quite as kind of nice, to put it politely. So we've spent lots of time and energy investing in images. Show of hands, people have seen this image before? A few people. So this is an image I see quite often on the web that is Terry Myerson when we announced HoloLens on January 21st back in Seattle. It was great fun to take this photograph. I was stood again kind of here with Brian at rehearsal. And Terry, I wanted to get this image of Terry silhouetted against the logo. And so I spent basically 5 minutes saying, Terry, move your hands up, move them down, move them left, move them right, and basically turned Terry Myerson into a robot for about 5 minutes. It was quite good fun. But we ended up with these iconic images that help our stories travel. This one is going to sound ironic, stood where I am right now, but another thing that we've learned is the details matter. And in this case, the story I'm going to tell you is every inch matters. So about 18 months ago, back in March last year, the year before, we announced Office on iPad, and it was a big moment for the company, because not only did we announce Office on iPad, that was the first time that our CEO had done a public press briefing, so it was going to be his first time on stage in front of the press. And my boss, Frank, said to me about 2 weeks before this occasion, he said, Steve, you need to put an event on for the press in San Francisco, 100 people, go. I'd never done this before, and I thought, I wonder how you do these kind of things. So we put this event on, and we made some very specific decisions around this event. We wanted it to be very intimate, to feel like a conversation. And we made a few other decisions around we didn't have giant Microsoft logos everywhere, because it turns out we were inviting people to a Microsoft event. So when they get there, they don't need to be reminded that they're at a Microsoft event. So instead of having these giant flashing lights and logos, we had tiny logos. But probably the most important decision we made at that event, and you'll realize now why I said it's ironic, is that we lowered the stage height. We typically would do these events where they would be on a flat floor, so it wouldn't be a room like this, but imagine 100 people on a flat floor, and we would have a stage that was probably just a little bit lower than this. And so the people that I would be talking to at sort of eye level-ish would be the people in about the third or fourth row here. And if you guys were on a flat floor, it would feel distinctly like I was talking down to you. You create this natural barrier that just feels like, well, this person is lording over me rather than having a conversation with me. Because if I come down here and I talk to these folks, and I nearly fell again, it feels like much more unfortunately for people at the back, just because of the raked floor. But it feels now like much more of a conversation. And so we walked into this arena, this actually not an arena, it was a very small facility, and said, we're going to make the stage height 6 inches high at most. And what happened is this. People wrote about Office on the iPad, but the New York Post, a not insignificant publication, wrote about the event. They said this was a different company, a different Microsoft. GOM was the big stage. Satya's official coming out party was held in an intimate room where he stood at eye level with the audience of mostly reporters. And the next event we did 2 weeks later, the reason I say every inch matters is we did an event probably about 3 weeks later, actually. And I remember our CEO passing me in the corridor, and he said, Steve, how's the event coming along? I said, pretty well, Satya. You know, we're in good shape. He's like, stage height? I went, yep, stage height's nice and low. The CEO cared about the stage height because he wanted to have a conversation with people, not feel like he was talking down to people. So all of those details mattered. Other things mattered. The amount of power that we put in the room for journalists, the Wi-Fi capability we put in the room, you know, the lighting, the music, the food. And you might be sitting there thinking, well, where is he going with this? Because stories to many people are things that are written down, but it's not. Stories is everything. Everything you convey at an event or through your website or through how you communicate or the images, it's all part of the story. It's something that I've learned over the last few months. And then finally, this has been a change for us at Microsoft over the last, I would say, year or so, is that we now much more think about, we're in the theater business. We have these big events that we do, Worldwide Partner Conference, Convergence, Ignite, Build in San Francisco, thousands of people. And people come there in many ways to be entertained, and we truly are in the theater business. So we thought a lot more about actually applying theater. We now have a company that works with my team who are a theater company, and they come in and they teach people how to do improv. Because improv is really helpful if you're going to do a demo, and the demo kind of goes wrong, and you want to be able to move on your feet and be able to tell a story. And so we actually invest in theater training now with some of our staff. So I want to show you a great example of how I learned the lesson that we needed to do that kind of training. So this was about a little under 2 years ago, Worldwide Partner Conference in Toronto. And it was the first demo that we had ever done, the first large-scale live demo we had ever done of Skype Translator. And for some reason, I decided I was going to do the demo. I've not done a demo since then, or at least not a demo of this scale, because it scared the life out of me. But I'll show you how it went, and it will hopefully give you a sense of why we're in the theater business and why we think about that as part of our storytelling.
And we will see if it works. Fingers crossed. Go for it.
Okay, so I actually want to tell you a little story before we get into this demo, because the first time I saw this technology, I knew it was going to change my life. I knew it was going to change my family's life. So I moved to Seattle about 4 years ago, as you know. I have two small children.
And people didn't understand your English?
Well, they kind of understand my English. I'm getting there, slowly but surely, you know. So I moved to Seattle, and all of my family is back in the UK. And my mother-in-law is Chinese. And I've known my mother-in-law for 25 years, and I've exchanged about 6 words with her because I don't speak Chinese, and she doesn't speak English. But perhaps more. Is over 80.
For
so
some, that could be a virtue, I think.
This was not scripted.
I just thought of it. Go for it.
So, the thing I'm really interested in is having my two small children. So, I have a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old. And wouldn't it be wonderful if in the lifetime of my mother-in-law, of their grandmother, that they would be able to have a conversation with her in the language. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we didn't have flies around? Wouldn't it be wonderful if those two small children could sit there in front of the TV and be able to have a conversation in real time in their language, and for my mother-in-law to have a conversation in her language? So we're going to try and see that in action. I'm expecting a call any moment now from a friend of mine, Melanie. Melanie's German, and she has been celebrating for the last few days, as you can imagine. So any second now, I'm expecting a call from Melanie, and here she is.
Germany had just won the World Cup, of course.
Hello.
Good afternoon, Melanie. How are you?
Aber nach neuen Melanie, wie geht es dir?
Mir geht es gut. Wie geht es dir?
Well, how is it me, friends?
Sorry, Melanie, say that again.
Melanie, sag das nochmal.
Mir geht es gut. Wie geht es dir?
I am well. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. I'm here at the Worldwide Partner Conference with 16,000 partners and our CEO on the big stage. So no pressure.
Gut, danke. Ich bin hier. Aber weltweite Partnerkonferenz mit 16.000 Palmos auf der großen Bühne. Also, kein Druck.
Hast du die Weltmeisterschaft gesehen?
Have seen the World Cup.
Yes, I did see the World Cup. Congratulations.
Ja, ich sah die Weltcup-Glückwünsche.
Ich könnte gar nicht glücklicher sein. Ich habe die ganze Nacht gefeiert.
I could not be happier. I celebrated the whole night.
In einem einzigen Spiel hat Deutschland mehr Tore geschossen als England in den letzten zwei Veranstaltungen zusammen.
A single game Germany has scored more goals than England in the last two events together.
Very funny, Melanie. I'm more of a cricket fan.
Sie voll, Melanie. Ein Cricket-Fan bewegen.
Was machst du nach der Veranstaltung?
What are you doing after the event?
This afternoon, I fly back to Seattle. Then on Thursday, I fly to New York, followed by Miami, then back to Seattle. And at the end of July, I'm going to fly to the UK to see my friends and family in London.
Heute Nachmittag. Ich fliege zurück nach Seattle. Und dann am Donnerstag, ich fliege nach New York gefolgt von Miami. Und dann zurück nach Seattle. Und am Ende Juli werde ich fliegen nach Großbritannien, um meine Freunde und Familie in London zu sehen.
Wow, das klingt nach einem vollgepackten Kalender.
Wow, that sounds like a packed calendar.
Gute Reise.
Good journey.
Thanks, Melanie. Goodbye.
Danke, Melanie. Wiedersehen.
Danke dir. Schönen Abend noch.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Good night.
That still scares the life out of me when I see that demo, because it was done without any safety net whatsoever. And in fact, the final rehearsal we did the night before, it just got words completely wrong. And by wrong, I mean it would translate things like the into F-U-C-K. Which is funny now, but isn't very funny when you're on the stage with your CEO with 16,000 people. So what did I learn from that one? Well, I learned that I probably wouldn't do, maybe I would do that again, because when it goes well, boy, it goes well. I don't know if you could see the translation, but that last long sentence, it translated it absolutely perfectly, word for word. And it generated a huge amount of coverage for that piece of technology. So it was great fun to do, but it also taught me that when I walked off stage, somebody said to me, what would you have done if that had gone wrong? And I said, I'm not really sure. Which is why I now think about this sort of improv and being in the theater business and how do we deal with those types of scenarios. So we're going to, oh, and that was me the night before. I stood there rehearsing the demo with the boss. So I'm going to wrap up and leave time for a few questions. But a few things I wanted you to sort of take away. Hopefully you've taken away some things as we've gone on this journey, this three-chapter story. Around, images matter and great stories matter and people need to go on a journey and people need to be transformed. But if I give you some sort of hard and fast advice, number one would be if you're genuinely interested in stories and the craft of storytelling, there is no better book on the planet than this one. It's called Resonate by Nancy Duarte. Nancy wrote another book a few years ago called Slideology. It's a great book that teaches you how to put together great slides and give great presentations. This particular one, it doesn't set itself up as being a book about storytelling. But when you read the book, that's exactly what it's about. And it goes, for example, into great detail on Star Wars, and it deconstructs Star Wars, and it tells you and shows you why that is a great story. And it's no accident in any way at all. The way that the arc of the story inside of Star Wars was crafted is broken down, and Nancy really shows you how to think about and gives you some real practical tools for how you can do great storytelling and craft great stories. The second one is more sort of just advice on how to approach stories. And my advice is be curious. And by that, I don't mean be odd. I mean be curious about things. Be naturally curious about things in the environment. This is a sign that a few weeks into my job in Seattle, I was walking through one of our buildings, and I went past a door, and it had this sign on. And the sign basically says, giant laser in here, don't come in. And I looked at it, and I thought, wonder what's inside there. Knock, knock, knock. And this guy opened the door, wild-eyed scientist at Microsoft called Stevie Batich, who is incredible. And for the next 2 hours, I said, what goes on in here? He's like, well, let me show you. Come on in. And he showed me just some amazing technology. This is the guy who invented the original Surface, the guy who the Surface table that some of you will be familiar with. He invented the Surface keyboard. He's done some amazing work around optics and imagery. He was involved in all of the Surface products as we currently know them. And became a great friend, and I've told some great stories with him. But I would have never have probably come across Stevie had I not knocked on the door and said, what goes on in here? So just be curious and look for the signs of stories that are sort of all around us. And then finally, images. It sounds incredibly obvious, but in this world of being bombarded with information, there is still a place for 3,000-word, for 12,000-word stories. But they have to be really, really good to capture people's attention for that amount of time. But one of the ways you can capture people's attention is through great imagery. And that adage is true. A picture, the right picture, can tell 1,000 words, and in some case, tens of thousands of words. So if you really care about storytelling, one of the pieces of craft that either I would encourage you to develop yourselves or work with is find great photographers who can help you tell visual stories. So those are sort of my three tips, if you like. And also, if you can find a great cartoonist, we work with this great cartoonist called Humor Cloud. He does lovely illustrations for us like this. But anyway, that's the end of my talk. Thank you so much for laughing at my crappy jokes. And thanks for staying. We have about 15 minutes for questions. If you need to leave, feel free to. But if you have questions, I'd love to take them either now or via email. But I will say before everyone leaves, thank you. It was great to see so many people show up. And it's good to be on the same stage as the pub landlord. Thank you. Any questions? There's one up at the back here. Go ahead, sir. I think he's going to bring a mic. Excellent.
So it's great. Hey, Chris Fogler's hero story, the writer's journey, the hero's journey, there's always the refusal of the call, the first piece of that, they refuse to call to action, which is kind of a pessimistic angle. Do you make use of that? Is that strong?
We do. Have- Excellent. I wish I could do that every time. Sometimes I would say that we don't stick religiously to the hero's journey or to the full here's how you should do stories that here's how it says you should do them in the manual. So quite often we'll do stories about people at Microsoft, profiles of people, and we'll have some elements of the journey they've been on. But at times have we used the technique of the refusal of the call? I would say yes, for sure. Like in the Kenya story, we use that, but it's not something where we have a tick box and we say, does this story meet all of the characteristics of a great sort of story in the classical sense?
Speaking of Microsoft people and journeys, do you ever get sent to Building 7?
Building 7? No. Is there a Building 7? No.
It doesn't exist.
I was just thinking, there isn't a Building 7. But our campus is weird because I was driving around it with my kids last weekend, and it's enormous. Like, it's no longer 88 acres. It's giant. And my kids said to me, how many buildings are on campus, Dad? And I know that there is a building 128, but there aren't 128 buildings. So we don't have a sequential set of buildings. But very good trick question, sir. Tusker T-shirt for you. Any other questions?
Yeah,
Oh, right here. Hello there. See, if the stage was lower, I wouldn't have had. You wouldn't have had to do that at all. I've heard of one recently. So a large telecoms operator in Canada phoned me up in a similar way to Daryl got the phone call from the governor of the state of Tennessee. A guy who works in the communications department of this mobile operator phoned me up and he said, hey, we've been watching what you've been doing, telling stories inside of Microsoft. Can we come and do a case study on you? And we said, yeah. And they came down and they spent 2 days interviewing people on my team, shooting video, and basically used us as a case study to say, look at what these guys have done. They built a storytelling department inside of Microsoft, and they've been very successful with it. So on an organizational basis, I've seen it. I've seen that most recently happen. But just on an individual basis, I'm trying to think, have I seen a... Lots of the people who are in my team, and I don't have a giant team, but very few of them come from a traditional, I would say, communications or PR background. Most of them just come from an evangelism background and just have a passion to go and tell stories. So I don't know if that's a great answer to your question, but I think demonstrating that other people are doing it and the journey they're being on is certainly one way. Pleasure. Yeah, there's a question back here, gentleman in the red.
Yeah, how do you interact with the corporate arm of Microsoft? So you obviously storytelling business, how do you interact? You know, how does that work?
It's easy. I am the corporate arm of Microsoft. So seriously, the group I sit in runs corporate communications for the company. So part of my team owns the Microsoft News Center, the YouTube channel, the Twitter handle. So we basically have, we used to have a very traditional corporate communications function that sits inside of the Microsoft corporate function. And we, you know, we basically built up enough credibility through the stories that we've told to be able to have license that we very rarely get told or asked not to go and do a story that we'll propose to do. It's really just been about credibility. We struck lucky with that 88 acres story at the start, that's for sure. So there's definitely been some luck on our journey.
Just a small question. When you have maybe a minute or less to sort of do your elevator pitches, what would be an advice to sort of get to do that?
I got asked this today by a journalist, and they basically said that, you know, give me what's the one thing, what's the most important thing? The most important thing at the end of the day is there has to be a good story. Like, you just can't turn crap into a good story. And I get presented with it, not often, I wouldn't say I get presented with crap, but I get invited to go and tell stories, as I mentioned earlier, where there just is no story there. So having a series of questions, like if somebody says, I want to go and tell this particular story, the lesson is really to ask some questions and say, well, who is the hero? What is the journey they've been on? And the hero can be a product. It can be a piece of technology. But it has to have gone on a journey somewhere. It can't just be this unimpeded march to glory, because that's not a story that anybody wants to see. You know, if you think of every movie you see, actually, the other piece of advice I would give people, the Nancy Duarte book, the other book to get, and I was reminded of it last night by the gentleman from Pixar. If you haven't read Creativity, Inc. by Ed Catmull, who's the guy behind Pixar, that is a phenomenal book about storytelling, both about the craft of storytelling, but how to build a business that's a storytelling business. But to answer your question, honestly, it's really simple. It's don't get suckered into telling a story where there isn't a story. And stories, actually, here's the other piece that I said to the journalist today. All the best stories start with people. So you can do a story about a product. But the reality is the best stories start with people, because that's where you're going to get texture, color, you know, people who've been on a journey, people who've encountered conflict. That's at the heart of every single great story you'll see on our website, microsoft.com/stories. It really is stories about people. Any other questions? We've got time for maybe one or two more. Gentlemen here. Yeah, I think there's definitely room for it. There is, so if people can hear the question, it was, is there room for people, for companies who want to tell bad stories or where things have gone wrong? There is definitely room for it. There is a huge nervousness in many organizations, certainly in our organization, around, well, how do you tell a sort of warts and all story? And I would say that we've done some of that. I think there are a couple of stories we're working on at the moment where I think we will look to do a little bit more of that. But it's a difficult thing to do, for sure. You know, you need to have, back to the question earlier on around, you know, corporate support, you need to have the backing to say, yes, we're going to give ourselves license to make ourselves look bad, but equally demonstrate that we learn from that and therefore we're doing something good. So there is room for it. Yep. Yeah, there's also, though, you reminded me as you said that, there are some areas where we've looked and said, we can see where people might mistell a story. So we've chosen to proactively tell a story to insulate ourselves against that type of thing. We did a story on Cortana recently on our stories website. And there was some confusion around Cortana and what the history of Cortana and where it came from. And, you know, confusion that probably, you know, could have potentially gone in a bad direction for us. And so we proactively wrote a story and then pointed media to that story to say, no, you can read the story on Wikipedia if you like, but the true story is here. And, you know, Microsoft are the custodians of that brand and that technology, so we feel like we owe it to that brand to tell the story truthfully. Any other questions? Going once. All right, saved by the bell. Very good. You should work in the casino up here or something.
How accurate would you say that overly was?
Sorry, say that. Say that again. Yeah, I love the book. It was by Bob Cringely. And how accurate, which part would you say? I would say it's pretty accurate. There are some great, great pieces in that book. If people haven't seen it, it got turned into, I think, a movie that was not that good. But was the book originally called Pirates of Silicon Valley? I think it was. There's a book out there by a guy called Bob Cringely or Robert X. Cringely. And it's this really pretty interesting and quite funny history of the PC industry. And there's two favorite parts in that book, but one of them in particular, I think it's chapter 3 in that book. Not that I've read it a few times, is the chapter is called The Demo God, and it's this whole chapter about Bill Gates and how Bill did this demo of, I think it was at CES probably 25 years ago, of BASIC or Word or something where there was something like 15 or 20 known bugs in the system, like showstopper bugs, that if you came across this bug during the demo, you were done, your demo was over. And Bill had gained this reputation as being this guy who somehow, either just by, you know, a sixth sense or just being lucky, managed to navigate his way around all of these bugs. That particular part of the story I thought was brilliant. It's a great, great book. There's another one out there if you want those types of books. There's one called Showstopper, which I think is out of publication now, but it's the journey and the story behind the building of Windows NT. That's another fascinating book. Okay, here we go again. Get ready, sir. Going once. The frequency of the stories we do. It's pretty frequent. So I know the schedule for the next 8 weeks, and we probably have 8 different stories. It's a mix of, some of them are quite lightweight, not in terms of the story, but the length of the story. And they're often, we do people profiles quite regularly now. Because I think there is... there's another analogy I'll give you of why I sort of got into this storytelling business. If you ever go to Microsoft in the UK and you travel, it's the headquarters in a place called Reading, and the main train line from Reading runs past the Microsoft offices from Reading to London Paddington. And so I used to take that train journey quite a lot, and you would drive past the Microsoft office, and it's basically 4 gray boxes, which I thought was a very fitting sort of analogy for how many people historically and maybe still today think about Microsoft. It's just this gray box over here. But inside those gray boxes, and there are many more of those gray boxes in Redmond, there are these incredible people doing incredible world-changing things. And I'm going to go off on another tangent here. So one of them, I ran across this guy a couple of years ago, and his name was David Heckerman. David Heckerman. And you should go and read this story. So Heckerman, about 10 years ago, used to work on the Outlook team. And remember when spam was a really big problem? It's not been completely eradicated. I don't mean spam the food, obviously. I mean, because that's not a big problem. Well, it kind of is a big problem. But email spam was a big problem. And Bill Gates had made this big statement around, we're going to eradicate spam. And David Heckerman was one of the guys behind this. And Heckerman built a set of algorithms that basically would figure out how to combat spam. And that's why we frankly see a lot less spam in our inboxes these days, whether it's Outlook or Exchange or Office 365 or historically Hotmail. David wrote these amazing algorithms to combat spam. And so you wind forward 8 years, and David is still at the company, but he now works in Microsoft Research down in, I think, Santa Barbara. And the current work that he's doing is he's building and testing, he's in field testing with a vaccine for curing HIV. And you think, well, how did he get from here doing email spam to building a vaccine for HIV? And it turns out that he's using a very, very similar version of the technology. Because if you think about spam, you know, we've all got spam, and you get the email and it says, you know, come and buy, you know, product X. Let's just say, you know, well, spam basically mutates. The way that it gets into your inbox is that the spammers will change certain characters, and they will continue to get around your spam filters by changing certain characters, you know, changing an S to a dollar sign or changing an A to a, you know, an A with an umlaut or something like that. That's exactly the way the HIV virus works. It's inside of your body, and it manages to navigate its way around the inhibitors inside of your body. So they basically use the exact same technology to build an HIV vaccine as they used to build spam filters years ago, and it seems like the testing of it is going successfully. And now I've completely forgotten what your original question was and how I got there. What was the question again? The frequency, yes. Don't know. Probably a good place to finish. Thank you, everyone.